This is Culturetopia, a rundown of the week's best arts reporting from National Public Radio. I am Netta Ulaby, reporter for NPR's Arts Desk.
And I'm Bob Mondello, and I guess I'm a movie critic, mostly.
I think you mostly are. Mm-hmm. Every week we bring you the best cultural coverage, from books and music to movies, television, and everything in between.
And you can find links to all the stories we feature each week at npr.org/culturetopia. This week,
a composer who writes his music for monkeys.
A look back at a golden age of comedy in the 1970s.
And electronic pop artist Imogene Heap tells us why the internet inspired her to use a theremin. But first, Bob, you recently reviewed a movie called The Cove, and you loved it.
Well, I loved it, but oh boy, it's rough viewing. The hardest thing to do was figure out how to get people to go to it, because it is about a dolphin slaughter.
Hundreds of thousands of dolphins have died there. You'll see the signs, keep out. The fishermen told me, they said, if the world finds out what goes on here, we'll be shut down. Can you imagine that? They actually told us that.
And one of the things that they had in mind when they made this picture, it was made by the guy who years and years ago trained Flipper. And he started to feel that he had done this terrible thing later when he saw what was happening to the dolphins when they were taken to these sea parks and things like that. And he started trying to stop the roundup of dolphins, because a lot of them get killed. Some of them are put into SeaWorlds, and others of them are simply chopped up and used as food and things like that. And he started thinking this was really awful. He focused on a cove in a place called Taiji in Japan, where it's illegal to shoot, to show what's going on there. Well, the result of that was that ideally what he was going to do was he brought this out in the middle of the summer, hoping that it would stop the slaughter of the dolphins in September. And now it's September. And so Guy Raz talked to the filmmaker to find out what had happened.
I think maybe it's over. I'm hoping it's over, that they'll just give up, stop killing dolphins here.
What happens when you and all the international press leave Taiji? I mean, are you worried that the dolphin hunters will sort of breathe a sigh of relief and then just carry on with the slaughter?
Yeah, we don't know. We don't know what's going to happen. It's a day-by-day thing here, you know. We just don't know.
I have to say, when I saw this picture, I got so angry watching it. I mean, the picture just makes you mad that any of this could go on. And you sit there and you just kind of hope that it's over, right? That this will have that effect. It's agitprop. It's a documentary trying to do something. And you just have to hope it did.
Well, we've got more animal news in our next story. It's about a composer who sought to figure out how and why music has such a hold on our emotions. He said he gained insight by writing music not for humans, but for monkeys. NPR's Richard Harris has the story.
David Tai is a cellist who plays with the National Symphony Orchestra and even on occasion with the heavy metal band Metallica. And he's a composer. He's also been developing a theory to explain why music plays on human emotions. His theory is that music relates to the most primitive sounds we make and respond to, like laughter, heartbeats, or a mother's cooing.
When I thought I had all the pieces put into place, I figured any good theory is testable. So one of the ways to test it would be to see if I could write music that would be effective for a species other than human.
He wrote to Chuck Snowden, a psychology professor who managed a colony of monkeys called cotton-top tamarins at the University of Wisconsin. Snowden says he was happy to cooperate, and he sent Tai recordings he'd made in the lab.
That's an animal that's being threatened by a veterinarian, so he's very upset. He's coming out to the front of the cage as though to attack or show aggressiveness.
Snowden also sent a sound that, believe it or not, monkeys make when they're feeling mellow. That's a quick one. Again? With those samples and a few others as a starting point, David Tai composed music for monkeys. He played the compositions on his cello and then electronically boosted them up 3 octaves to a pitch that matched the monkeys' voices. Monkeys don't respond at all to music written for humans, but they did respond when they heard this composition written specifically for them. Chuck Snowden says people may not be calmed by this relatively fast tempo, but the monkeys in his lab certainly were.
this is a rhythm that approaches the resting heart rate of a tamarin, and had this calming effect on them, even though the pum 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 in the background was maybe a bit faster than we would expect as humans for this music.
Compare that with the music that Ty wrote to see if he could agitate the monkeys, a la Metallica. But is it really music?
I wouldn't say so, to be honest.
Josh McDermott studies music and the brain at New York University.
There's always this sort of issue of how you ought to define music.
And in this case, McDermott says it's impossible to say whether the monkeys are reacting to the musical elements that Ty has added to the recordings, or simply to the sounds that mimic monkey voices. And that's the nub of the issue. Ty is, after all, trying to understand the nature of music, what makes it tug at his heartstrings. It's a question so powerful, at first he was afraid even to ask it.
The paradox is that I distinctly remember thinking once that when they figure out why Puccini makes me cry, I hope I die the day before the news gets out. But the great news about this exploration into music is that it's actually more magical and wonderful once you realize how it works.
In fact, Ty is now hoping to use his insights to compose music that will appeal to other species and to trigger even deeper emotional reactions in us. Richard Harris, NPR News.
How cool. I don't know about you, but I'm all agitated.
I think I'm part monkey. I liked that music.
That was really kind of neat, wasn't it?
That's great. Interesting. Los Angeles in the mid-1970s was a very funny city. Comedians from all over the country were flocking there, inspired by Tonight Show host Johnny Carson, who was known to discover new comedic talent. William Nadelsuter is a Los Angeles Times reporter who covered the city's burgeoning comedy scene. He's written a new book called I'm Dying Up Here, and he chronicles what he calls stand-up comedy's golden era. Nadelsuter spoke with Ari Shapiro about the book.
It was absolutely electric, and they would all share stuff, and they would write stuff down on napkins, and they'd be hanging out at the bar between sets. I mean, and, you know, it's hard to imagine now, but that you on a random Friday night you could see Letterman and Leno and Richard Lewis and Robin Williams and Elaine Boozler all on the same stage.
Will you read a passage from the book that kind of captures a bit of that sense? This is on page 106.
Ringo Starr made a memorable solo appearance at Sunset one night, arriving so intoxicated that Mike Binder, who was working the door, had to help him to a seat in back. Starr was seated just as David Letterman took the stage, and the former Beatle immediately began heckling him, which attracted the attention of every comic within earshot. Letterman had a reputation for eviscerating hecklers, and as word spread along the back hallway, other comics started filing into the room to watch the impending bloodshed. It wasn't a fair fight. In the spotlight, Letterman couldn't see who the heckler was, so he showed no mercy, and Starr was too drunk to appreciate how badly Letterman was beating him up. Finally, one of the comics took pity and called out, "Hey, Dave, it's Ringo." "Oh, that makes sense," Letterman shot back in the direction of Starr. "You ruined your career, and now you've come here to ruin mine." George Miller almost fell off his stool laughing.
Were you there that night?
No, I was not. I was there on other nights, but not that one.
You know, so many of the people you write about in this book died before their time. Is it difficult to see the immense talent that is no longer with us?
Yeah. Well, that sort of happened with that generation in comedy and rock and roll. I think there was probably more drugs in the rock and roll arena.
You write about all-night cocaine sessions with the comedians.
Yep, that did happen. But it wasn't part of the comedy lifestyle. There were some who did that. There were a lot of them who didn't. I mean, you know, Jay Leno was an absolute straight arrow. Letterman, they didn't do that. And you know, comics didn't make enough money to buy cocaine. You know, they were lucky to buy pot.
Robin Williams had the line that cocaine is God's way of telling you you're making too much money.
A very true statement.
I did a piece this week about a word that's used by comedians and grade school kids. It's a very garden variety insult. The word is retard, and it's one E. Duff Robel used to use occasionally. Then his daughter was born with Down syndrome. She was a baby when he had her in a car seat, and another car cut him off. Like anyone else, Robel started yelling.
And I actually said that word, and then I stopped my car and got teary, and I thought, oh my gosh, I can't believe I just said that.
Robel started a passionate anti-retard campaign. To him, it's hate speech.
I'd like to get it to where it's bleeped off the television. I've written to every commissioner on the FCC. I've written to the president. I've written to Oprah 5 times.
And Robel has made a few inroads. Alongside the activists who made retard unacceptable in medical and social service circles, there the term intellectual disabilities is preferred. They organize against movies like last summer's hit film Tropic Thunder. In one memorable exchange, two movie stars discuss the kind of roles that can win you Oscars.
Everybody knows you never go full retard.
What do you mean?
Check it out. Dustin Hoffman, Rain Man, look retarded, act retarded, not retarded. Tom Hanks, Forrest Gump. Slow, yes, braces on his legs, but that ain't retarded. You went full retard, man.
The protest against Tropic Thunder did not have much effect on the movie. But not long ago, film critic Eric Snyder was reviewing a DVD for a stinker of a film called Miss March.
Hey, gang, we're here today to talk to you about
Miss March is an insult comedy. That's all it is. It came out in theaters last spring, but Snyder realized it was changed for DVD.
I noticed a scene where it's a couple of abstinence promoters are telling horror stories to middle school students.
He got syphilis.
Then she got pregnant, and because she smoked cigarettes, the baby came out a crackhead.
It was obvious that the actress's lips did not say crackhead.
They said retard.
It added up to, about 5 instances in the movie where obviously they had redubbed it for the DVD.
And it's not just movies rethinking retard as an easy laugh. A few months ago, popular sex advice columnist Dan Savage renounced his use of the word.
You know, I just sat down to write the column, and I'd used the word retard in the column recently, and I was sorting through the mail, and there was a handful of letters taking me to task, and I thought, all right, I won't use it anymore. I'll use a new word. I hope you like this one better.
The new word was leotard, as in, you are totally leotarded.
It was me just being a jerk, frankly. You know, I've heard people now use the R word in reference to retard, and it just seems so pansy-assed, if I may use that phrase.
Savage is gay, and he knows how it feels to be the target of insults and slurs. What's funny is that gay and retard occupy the same linguistic position when it comes to schoolyard trash talk.
To mean bad, you know, that movie was totally gay.
Jesse Scheidlauer is an editor for the Oxford English Dictionary. He traced the use of retard as an insult to a late 1950s book that refers to Playboy magazine.
And a character says, well, that Hefner jazz is for retarded jockstraps.
Retarded is an all-purpose put-down, says Scheidlauer. Same goes for gay. They don't mean something is literally intellectually disabled or literally homosexual. And that differentiates those words from racist slurs. Atlantic Monthly columnist Ta-Nehisi Coates writes on issues like race and language.
And I actually love the word nigger. I actually like it a lot. I don't like it used towards me in certain contexts. But I think nigger's a great word. I think it's a fine word.
Coates says in order for language to become socially unacceptable, it needs to be linked with the kind of bigoted behavior no one wants to be associated with.
As a young man, I use the word chink all the time. Fag, another word I used. There's nothing for me to deploy that word. We referred to the corner store as the chink store and thought nothing of it, never considered it.
And, Coates says, in order for retard to be considered inappropriate, there needs to be a fundamental shift in empathy for people with intellectual disabilities.
What happens is, if you're lucky, you come to understand that those words describe actual human beings.
Until then, retard may continue as a commonplace zinger, but it seems people are beginning to think twice about it.
Bob, when I was working on this piece, I mentioned it to you because you and I sit very close to each other, and you told me a story that I'm hoping you'll tell again.
When I was in high school, I was on the school marching band, and this is a story about the word retard, but in the sense of to slow down.
Yeah.
I was on the school marching band, and we fancied ourselves intellectuals. I don't know how smart we actually were, but we thought we were smarter than the guys on the football team, at least. And we had to be on the marching band. We were orchestra people. We thought I played the bass clarinet. I didn't think of myself in that way. And we had to march around the field, and it felt really dumb. And so we wanted to prove that we were smarter than everybody else out there. And so we made up our own cheers for the games. And you know, everybody else is yelling, push them back, way back. And we had one that we chanted by ourselves, and no one would join us on this chant when we chanted it. But it was, retard them, make them relinquish the ball. I don't know if that proved we were smarter, but they were big words.
I think it's a much more sophisticated chant. Yeah, well, you might
we didn't get think. We didn't get very far with it. We never persuaded anybody else to join us in that, including the National Merit Scholars. So useless.
Now those National Merit Scholars might be a little too old for a new kid's book.
Ah, yes. The novel Hunger Games has spent 50 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list for kids' chapter books. It takes the concept of the reality show to a futuristic extreme. Hunger Games is the first book in a planned trilogy. The second book, Catching Fire, comes out this week. NPR's Lynn Neary talked with the author, Suzanne Collins.
As a child, Suzanne Collins was obsessed with Greek mythology, and one of her favorites was the myth of Theseus and the Minotaur. She was struck by the cruel punishment that Crete had imposed on Athens for being on the wrong side of a war. Every year, the Athenians had to send 7 young men and 7 maidens to be thrown into the labyrinth and devoured by the Minotaur.
And even when I was a child, I was blown away by how evil that was. It was like Crete was sending this very clear message, which was, if you mess with us, we'll do something worse than kill you. We will kill your children.
In Collins' story, 24 young men and women from 12 districts in what was once North America, but is now a country called Panem, are sent to the Hunger Games every year as punishment for a war that happened 75 years ago. Collins remembered the gladiator movies that were popular when she was young, most notably Spartacus, the story of a slave who led an unsuccessful but heroic rebellion. One scene in that film has become iconic. The defeated slaves have been told they will not be punished as long as they turn in their leader. As Spartacus stands up to identify himself, the others join in one last act of defiance to protect him.
I'm Spartacus!
I'm Spartacus!
I'm Spartacus!
I'm Spartacus!
I'm Spartacus! I'm Spartacus!
Collins uses a similar image in Catching Fire. The heroine of the trilogy, 16-year-old Katniss Everdeen, won the Hunger Games, but she also defied the all-powerful government during the competition with symbolic gestures and actions. In doing so, she has inspired the stirrings of rebellion across the country. In this excerpt from the book, Katniss appears before a crowd during a government-sponsored victory tour.
What happens next is not an accident. It is too well executed to be spontaneous because it happens in complete unison. Every person in the crowd presses the 3 middle fingers of their left hand against their lips and extends it to me. It is our sign from District 12, the last goodbye I gave Rue in the arena. If I hadn't spoken to President Snow, this gesture might move me to tears. But with his recent orders to calm the districts fresh in my ears, it fills me with dread.
Only gradually, says Collins, does Katniss begin to understand that she has become a symbol of the spreading rebellion.
It's this awakening. This is not one who, a character who starts out as this hot-headed rebel. This is someone who has, you know, rebel status thrust upon her, and is not always comfortable with it, did not plan on it, but eventually is able to carry it.
There's a bit of rebellion in the music of Imogen Heap. You never know what she might use as an instrument, maybe a synthesizer, a sequencer, a household item, anything up to and including the kitchen sink. Melissa Block spoke with Imogen Heap about her new record, Ellipse, and how she's embraced the internet as a source of inspiration.
One time I was on Twitter and somebody just kind of randomly said, oh, why don't you throw some theremin on the record? You know, I love theremin. And I was like, okay, yeah, theremin could be good. And that kind of stored it in the back of my mind. And then there was this song that I was working on called Swoon. And it was almost finished. It was, you know, it was really nearly there, but there was something missing. And I couldn't for the life of me figure it out. And then kind of this little piece of information, this little tweet kind of came to the forefront of my mind.
The theremin tweet.
The theremin tweet, yeah. And I said, oh, that maybe I should try a theremin type of sound. So I went onto the internet and I typed in theremin logic patch and I downloaded this little patch and within 5 seconds I had a theremin sound.
Stuck in a cinema, oh, saving me from a coil. Suddenly realize and fall into
it kind of goes, da, da.
Oh, yeah, that ghostly sound.
Yeah. But if it wasn't for that guy saying theremin, I would never have thought of it.
And that came from a tweet.
It did. It came from a tweet. The idea came from a tweet.
You have so much fun layering all kinds of sounds in your songs. I wonder, let's take a listen to one of the songs, and if you can deconstruct it a little bit for us. I'm thinking of the song title.
Okay. So here you're hearing a mixture of real strings and programmed strings. In the background, okay. That sound that's going do 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 do. That's actually an Indian flute, kind of tuned down and made in chords by this guy called Ashwin Srivinisan. And that sound there, you can hear. That thing. That's Ashwin as well on his flute. That's the flute as well. Loads of vocals, acoustic guitar, played very badly by me, and then kind of pieced together so it sounds kind of half decent. And some kind of nice synthy sound that ding 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 ding. I don't know half the time how I made these sounds. Okay, that sound, that doop 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 thing, was can't remember the name of it. Game Boy. It was a Game Boy. It's a little Game Boy that my friend Pixel Hate has kind of hacked into.
Really?
And so I can use it as a kind of keyboard. I sprung up in hot sand, I rose
super high. That's it for this week.
You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this here podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I am Netta Ulibe.
And I'm Bob Mondello.
Thanks for joining us on Culturetopia.